as some of you know, was born just up the road a piece in Jamestown, North Dakota. Now, Monday night's Peggy Lee tribute is hosted by James Gavin. Mr. Gavin is the go-to guy when it comes to Peggy Lee. His book, titled Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee, provides the basis for this Guthrie presentation next Monday evening. The title is, of course, from Peggy Lee's 1969 hit song of the same name. It's a song that, may I say, continues to mystify, to puzzle, to entertain, to entrance after all these years. We can talk about all that and more right now because the man himself, yes, the author, the host, the narrator, James Gavin, is with us for the next few minutes. Welcome, James Gavin. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this great entertainer from our corner of the world. We like to brag about her, James. You know why, don't you?
Yes, because Peggy Lee in the early 1940s spent some meaningful time singing in Minnesota, Minneapolis to be exact. Right before Benny Goodman discovered her, she spent a year or so there, going in and out of town, and boy, I wish there were some recordings existing from that period. I'd love to hear how she sounded before she joined Benny.
I'm sure you've rooted around for a long time trying to find recordings. Of course, recording devices were not all that plentiful or that good back in the day. This would have been, James, what period? We're talking the 30s or early 40s?
Actually, she was in Minneapolis in 1940 and into 41, which is when Benny Goodman discovered her singing in a cocktail lounge in Chicago. She made no commercial recordings prior to joining Benny, but she did a lot of radio in Minneapolis and also in her native North Dakota. She did local radio shows, and that's where the world first fell in love with Peggy Lee. I have a feeling that she sounded recognizably, if not sultry, still quite shy, withdrawn, timid, internalized, very sotto voce, which is the way that Peggy Lee always approached a song.
She didn't want to be a shouter. She didn't want to compete with the noise in the lounges and the rest. She wanted to kind of seduce them, right? A little bit.
That is correct. I think that it was also innate to her personality. Peggy Lee had grown up in very hard scrabble conditions in the North Dakota prairie, essentially, where life was really hard. Everybody had it hard. There was no point in complaining, and there was no point in raising your voice, because that's all that they ever knew. The winters were brutal. And therefore, you just took what was dealt to you and you made the most of it.
Yeah.
It did not mean, however, that you were not feeling intense feelings underneath the surface. And that is the secret of Peggy Lee's magic, because you had a very controlled and placid, cool exterior with volcanic emotions bubbling underneath.
Peggy was, the seventh of eight kids, and father worked for the railroad. The mother died when Peggy was young, and I think the woman, her father married the housekeeper, and she was not the easiest person to be around, so that might have had some effect on Peggy as well. But was it some radio guy at WDAY Fargo that gave her, took her birth name, Norma Eggstrom, and said, hey, you got to get rid of that. Let's call you Peggy Lee.
Yeah.
Is that how it happened?
Yes, that is how it happened. And the name Peggy Lee was a perfect name because it has rhythm. Peggy Lee. Rhythmically, it fits together perfectly. It almost sounds like a rim shot.
It does. It really does.
And Peggy Lee, as you know, was one of the most swinging pop jazz singers that ever was. And she learned it in interesting ways. She learned it from the clip-clopping of horses' hooves back in North Dakota. She also learned rhythm from trains pulling into stations because she spent a lot of time, obviously, around train stations. Mm-hmm. Most of all, I would say, she learned how to swing in her mid-teens from listening to broadcasts of the young and still unknown Count Basie Orchestra.
Right.
That's how she fell in love with jazz and with black music in particular.
Okay, train songs, Waiting for the Evening Train. Is that one she sang? Is that it?
You're close. It's called Waiting for the Train to Come In.
Okay, that's it.
And,
okay.
That was one of her first Capitol recordings. This was after Peggy had left the Benny Goodman Orchestra. She had become a star with Benny Goodman in 41, 42, into 43. She fell in love with and got pregnant by the guitar player, Dave Barber. And at that point, Peggy decided, and she was wrong, but she decided that domesticity and motherhood would be enough for her. It was a brief period in Peggy Lee's life of retirement, and I don't think it took too much effort for Capitol Records to persuade her to come back around 1944 and start recording again.
To back you up a minute, James Gavin, do you know the names of the clubs in Minneapolis where Peggy Lee sang?
You know something? I have my book open in front of me. And the first one and the most important place was in the ballroom of the Radisson Hotel.
Oh,
because
yes.
She was the girl singer for the collegiate dance band of Sev Olsen. And Peggy had auditioned for Sev Olsen with the song Body and Soul, a gut-wrenching song. She was 20 years old at the time. This was the summer of 1940. She fell in love with Sev, who was a looker. However, he was a married looker, and it didn't work out very well. But you know something, one of the people that I interviewed about that period, because she knew her then, was Jean Arland Peterson, who you know.
Oh, sure.
Peterson, musical Peterson family dynasty.
Yes.
And she said to me, and I'm quoting this, she said it was a sweet voice, and that Peggy had nice control and knew, quote unquote, and knew how to deliver a song, quote unquote, and that it was all at that time still very restrained. The thing about Peggy's singing is that question marks just swirl around her while she's singing. There are so many layers of mystery, and there is so much going on in those eyes that you can see but can't quite identify. She's a mystery story.
She
when
is.
She sings.
She truly is, and no better song exemplifies that than Is That All There Is. And we'll talk about that song in just a moment. The Benny Goodman connection, was it, you mentioned it happened in Chicago, I think, at a lounge in one of the hotels there. Wasn't it the then fiance of Benny Goodman who heard Peggy sing and said, went home and told Benny, hey, Benny, you better come down and listen to meet this gal. She's somebody you should know.
That is all correct. Benny was in a pinch because Helen Forrest had just left him. Helen, one of the great big band singers ever, had been driven crazy by Benny, as many people had, because Benny's social skills were horrendous, and Benny drove his musicians crazy with the sense that they were doing something wrong and that they were displeasing him. Benny was eccentric beyond words. And Benny needed a singer, and he needed one fast, and that singer was Peggy.
She said he showed up the next night, he looked at me, and the way he looked at me was very strange, very disarming. Peggy Lee thought, I don't think he likes me. I don't think he likes me. But it turns out he was just kind of studying her, looking not only her looks, but her manner. And I think he was trying to see her maybe as a polished up, you know, performer, the way he would want her to look. But he liked the sound already, I'm quite sure of that, didn't he?
Well, look, Benny took a chance on Peggy Lee, and no one that big had done that before. Benny did, for all of his weirdness, Benny was able to look at Peggy and see potential. And the thing that made Peggy such an interesting choice for a band singer is that big band singers, You were working in front of a swing orchestra. There was a lot of volume. There was noise in the ballroom. These were huge places filled with movement and shuffling and talking. And Peggy did not ever feel the need to sing above all of that. Her technique was the opposite. She pulled back. You had to come to her. And she had a certain charisma and a mystery about her that was very compelling, and it did make people stop dancing and huddle around the rim of the stage to study her as she sang. You know, many singers have been influenced by that style. Many singers have learned that you don't need to sell, and push in order to deliver a song, but that doesn't always work for other singers, because Peggy Cool, which she was one of the queens of, is all about what is simmering underneath. If there is not something underneath that's sort of fighting to get out, then it just sounds dull, in mm-hmm. my opinion. Mm-hmm. You could not only was Peggy this gorgeous rainwater blonde who just with alabaster skin, very Scandinavian. But there was, again, something in the eyes, and there was also a hint of pain in the voice.
Yes.
There were dark colors in that sweet sound that drew people in. That's certainly what made me fall in love with it.
Oh, I did. I echo that for sure. We're talking with James Gavin, the author of the biography of Peggy Lee, Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. And Mr. Gavin will be the host and the narrator next Monday night on stage at the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, a musical biography of Peggy Lee called Is That All There Is? We're giving away tickets. We'll give away another pair tomorrow on the show and then again on Friday. James Gavin, I was given your book as a gift, one of the best gifts I ever got. I think it was a couple years ago. I've read the book. It is fantastic. It's a great read. Where did you get that cover photograph of Peggy Lee? She's got these beautiful, beautiful, beautiful blonde tresses cascading down her head and coming to rest in big curves. Curls on her shoulder. She looks to be like 17 years old.
Thank you for asking, because I'm very proud of having found that picture. All throughout the course of my book, I was dreaming of finding a picture that would tell the story of my book in one frame.
Wow.
A dear friend of mine named Tom Toth, who has since left us, but Tom Toth was a great film historian and collector of films, and he had inherited a massive archive of rare Hollywood stills from John Springer, who had been the publicist for many big movie stars, including Joan Crawford. He worked for Peggy at the time of Is That All There Is, which was 1969. Now, John Springer had organized a photo shoot for Peggy with John Ingstead, who was a great Hollywood portrait photographer of that era. And Tom, my friend Tom, while I was trying to gather photos for the book, had pulled the Peggy Lee folder of photos from the John Ingstead Library and said, "Here, take it." And I looked inside and I found an absolutely pristine color transparency of the picture that landed on the cover.
Oh.
And when I saw it, I said, and it had never been published, by the way. Another shot from that same sitting had been used on a Capitol album of the same period. But this was the great shot from that sitting. And I looked at it and I said, "Oh my God, that's it." My dear editor at the Atria Books division of Simon & Schuster had to join me in fighting to get that on the cover, because someone in the production department thought it didn't look enough like Peggy Lee, and I wanted a more, shall we say, cliche photo of Peggy from the 50s. And thank God my editor put his foot down on my behalf.
Great.
And I love the cover of my book.
I do, too. It is at once this picture of Peggy Lee. She seems to be the ingenue, but also a seductress, too. And you can see, you talked about her porcelain skin and the pain in her eyes. It's all there.
Yes.
It's all there in that single photo.
Yes.
I don't want to go on and on about it. It's so arresting. The photograph just reaches out to you. It's great. James Gavin, how did Peggy get along with Benny? We're going to sample some of her music, of course, in just a minute here. But how did she get along with Goodman? He was not, as you have mentioned already, to many people, he was an absolute monster, a great musician. I think, what was it, Artie Shaw, when they came face-to-face, Artie said, we're both musicians. You play clarinet, I play music.
I didn't know that story. Peggy respected Benny and appreciated the fact that he had done an enormous career-making thing by hiring her. That said, she didn't like him because she was so insecure at that time, and Benny had a way of drawing out musicians' worst insecurities. And he drove her nuts with a sense that she was not pleasing him. But on the other hand, if it hadn't been for Benny Goodman, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah. True enough. So true. Let's talk about a song called Mr. Wonderful, if we could, James Gavin. This is the first time that Peggy shows up on the Billboard Top 100, and I believe this has to do with a Sammy Davis production of some kind, a movie or something. But tell us a bit. We're going to sample the song here, probably not play it all the way through, but what can you tell us about Peggy and Mr. Wonderful?
You know, there's not that much to say about her recording of it. She was under contract to Decca Records at that time, between, let's say, 52 and 57, I believe. And it was an incredibly rich period of Peggy's career, in that it began with Lover, which was a huge hit for her, that frenetic Latin version of a Rodgers and Hart waltz. And in the course of those years, she recorded a lot of pop songs and a lot of dumb songs that were aimed at the hit parade, and a lot of really deep, meaty, and dark material. Mr. Wonderful was just the title song of a Broadway show at a time when Broadway was an extremely fertile source of material for pop singers. And Peggy took a song that had been sung in a belting bravura fashion on Broadway, and she made it sound as though she were singing it into someone's ear from across a pillow.
Beautiful. This is how it went. Peggy Lee, 1956.
Why this feeling? Why this glow? Why the thrill when you say hello? It's a strange and tender magic you do, Mr. Wonderful, that's you.
James Gavin, Peggy Lee is singing to me, nobody else. It's got to be just me. Isn't that how it sounds?
That's always the way she made you think.
That's right.
It's intensely romantic. It's sexy.
It is.
It is, it's full of silence and space. Peggy understood the seductive power of silence, of holding back, of not pushing. It's utterly seductive to the ear.
It really is. It's just absolutely beautiful. That was Peggy Lee's first charting hit, 1956. I think it went to number 14 on the top 40, Mr. Wonderful. I think, as you mentioned, a Broadway musical, Sammy Davis was involved in that one. We all know 1958, 2 years later, Fever. Is there such a thing as a signature song for Peggy Lee? I would guess if there is, that would be it, wouldn't it?
She had, I would say, the two biggest ones are Fever and Is That All There Is, which you played earlier. But yes, Fever had been a rhythm and blues hit and not a big pop hit. And the original version of Fever by Little Willie John was really hot, and it was dense, and it had a lot of instrumentation, and it really spelled the sex appeal out. And it was Peggy's idea to pare it down to that stark, minimalist version that we heard with finger snapping. Some of these elements had been in the original, but Peggy Lee stripped away all of the clutter, and she added a big dose of mystery.
She really does. We're going to hear a bit of it right here. 1958, Peggy Lee. Boy, this is music with sex coming out of your radio speaker right here.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night. Sun lights up the daytime, moon lights up the night. I light up when you call my name, and you know I'm gonna treat you right. You give me fever.
Peggy Lee, 1958, number 8 on the charts, her highest charting song on the pop charts, so the Billboard Hot 100 then. And James Gavin, she rearranged the lyrics, didn't she? She obviously was a very fine lyricist in her own right and wrote a lot of songs, a lot of lyrics. But she took the Little Willie John version and switched it up a little bit here and there, didn't she?
Peggy added a couple of additional standards, the Captain Smith and Pocahontas mm-hmm. and the Shakespearean references and so forth, came from Peggy Lee. And they became so identified with the song that they were added to the sheet music later. Now, the way music song publishing works is that the original published version is the version. And that's just, and the people who are credited with that version are the ones who are paid. Peggy Lee was always annoyed, to put it mildly, that she did not get a cut of the profits for having written these additional lyrics that everybody knows and that were hers, but that's just the way the cookie crumbled, unfortunately.
Yes. She didn't suffer the indignity gladly, but she had to swallow that one anyway. Peggy Lee. James
That's
Gavin.
Correct.
James, are you able to hang with us for a few more minutes? We're just really enjoying
it. Oh, as long as you like. I'm loving this.
Thank you. We're going to run this right up to the end of the show today. That's another 15 minutes. James, if you could hang on for
Please.
A minute. We're going to thank you so much. We're going to take a commercial break, sir. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
To spend yeah. forever.
Hi, I'm Kathy Wolf Swanson.
And hey, I'm Pat Wolf.
Our motto has always been to ask for Wolfs. But Prohibition forced our family to stop brewing Wolf beer. To this day, our legacy can still be seen all over Stillwater.
So it's only fitting, Kathy, that Wolf beer is back in the valley, especially after a 93-year dry spell.
Don't you think Great-Grandpa Joe would be so proud?
I do. And that's why we invite you to visit wolfbrewing.com and click on Beer Finder to locate a store near you. And then ask for Wolfs, Stillwater's original craft beer.
We shared with you just a couple seconds ago a sizable piece of Is That All There Is, Peggy Lee's last big charting hit from 1969. There's a marvelous story behind this, and the man best suited to tell it is James Gavin, our guest here. James on the line from New York. He will be here. He will be on stage at the Guthrie Theater next Monday night as host and narrator of the musical biography Is That All There Is, of course, the title drawn from the song, and the title, coincidentally, of James Gavin's biography of Miss Peggy Lee, Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. And a kind of a strange story, James Gavin, about how this song, Is That All There Is, came to be. It mystifies, it still puzzles people after all these years, yours truly included, although I've tried to do a fair amount of research. It was written by the great songwriting team, Mike Stoller and Jerry Lieber. Peggy thought it was written for her. I don't think it really was written with her specifically in mind. I think Marlene Dietrich was considered for the singing role as well, but they got into the studio in January of 1969 with this song, and Peggy thought this would be a song for her for sure. Can you tell us what unfolded in the studio that day? And Peggy Lee walked into the studio, I believe, carrying a leather case. By Lieber and Stoller's account, it was brandy. By your account, it was cognac. But whatever it was, I guess it helped to fuel her musical prowess that day in the recording studio. What exactly happened that recording session day in January of 69?
Well, a bit of backstory, and that is that Peggy Lee at that time was professionally pretty washed up. Like most singers of her age and era, Peggy was being pushed aside. Recording contracts were dwindling for those people, and Capitol was ready to let Peggy go. Peggy heard this song. She heard a demo of this song, Is That All There Is? And although, as you say, it was not written for her at all, it wasn't intended for her, she identified with that song so intensely that she felt that somehow Lieber and Stoller, who had previously written a hit for her, they didn't write it for her again, but a song that became a hit for her, and that is I'm a Woman from 1963.
Mm. Oh, yes.
Peggy just got it in her head that this song was hers, that it had to be hers. Obviously, she was right. Nobody knew it at the time. Capitol Records allowed her as a courtesy to record this song in early 69. The conductor was the then unknown Randy Newman, mm-hmm. who had done one flop album and was not still considered a comer by any means. Lieber and Stoller's hit-making days were seemingly behind them, so they were they seemed to be washed up at the same time. And so then add to it this song that many perceived as too long and depressing. Mm. And it wasn't even a song exactly. It was largely spoken. But Peggy had an incredible instinct for unusual songs that other people didn't catch on to immediately, but that she sensed great potential in. And she felt that this song was her salvation.
Hmm.
Months passed, and Capitol was not releasing this, and truly had no intention of releasing it. And Peggy, in one of the most ingenious moves of her career, had the opportunity in the summer of 69 to perform on the Joey Bishop Show, up against the Tonight Show. It was basically a flop late night variety show.
Yeah.
But Peggy asked if she could sing "Is That All There Is?" Rather, she insisted.
Mm-hmm.
And Joey said, "Of course."
Mm-hmm.
And she sang this, and the proverbial switchboard lit up.
Mm-hmm.
And it was enough incentive for Capitol to release a small pressing of "Is That All There Is?"
Mm-hmm.
And it sold out quickly, and they did another pressing, and that sold out, and the rest is kind of history.
It really is.
This song, really, this was the end of the 1960s.
Right.
The Manson murders had happened, Woodstock had happened, and the civil rights movement was basically kaput at that point, and so much turbulence was going on that this song spoke to, and it centered on the big question again: is that all there is? What does this all mean? What good is anything? What difference right. does anything make?
Right.
And it spoke to, in Peggy, and in my opinion, an emptiness that nothing could quite fill.
Oh, wow. That really helps summarize the puzzle, the mystery that people have felt about this song over the years. If I could take it back briefly, ever so briefly, to the recording session, Peggy famously would say, "Listen, I don't do any more than three takes. That's it." But in this case, Lieber and Stoller, Drover, they were not satisfied even into take number 10. They still didn't have it, they felt. And by your telling, she did about 20 takes. By their telling, Lieber and Stoller, it was up around 34, 35. So I'm going to go with you. About, 20 takes?
I think you should. Yeah, Jerry exaggerated a lot.
I thought so.
To make a good story. Yeah. And it was mainly, in my from my research, it was mainly Jerry more than Mike who was being so finicky, because Jerry wrote the words and he didn't always feel that Peggy was quite nailing it. And the more and the deeper they got into it, I think the more, you know, sometimes how you can just keep doing things too often and you start to get sort of bent out of shape.
Diminishing returns.
It gets worse rather than better.
Diminishing returns, right, James?
Diminishing returns
That's
is
it.
The phrase
That's
I was
it.
Looking for.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Lieber and Stoller then sat in the editing booth chopping pieces together to create the perfect take of "Is That All There Is?"
Yeah, but
and
the perfect take, according to their ears, was lost because the recording engineer didn't hit the record button. And so, to their mind, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. But either Mike or Jerry, I forget which one it was, said that after that recording, they heard Peggy actually surpass the recording in person many times. Peggy continued to sing "Is That All There Is?" for the rest of her career. She, even after she had gotten sick of it, and even after she was weary of people perceiving it as a song of no hope, as so many people did, because Peggy didn't want to feel that there was no hope for her.
That's somewhat redeeming. I'm glad to hear that. James Gavin, can you tell us what's going to unfold on stage at the Guthrie Theater here next Monday night? You're going to be up there. You're going to be the host. You're going to be the narrator. What can we expect to see? We only have a couple of minutes left. Maybe you can give us a little sneak preview here.
All right. Our house band is the Wonderful New Standards. I don't have to say a thing about them. They are Twin Cities institutions. The singers are Jonathan Brooke, a marvelous singer-songwriter that I've admired for years, the wonderfully wacky and intellectual, brilliant Nellie Mackay, and Catherine Russell, a terrific jazz singer. They will be presenting in story form in the signature songs of Peggy Lee. I will be adding a narrative that will wrap around the songs and weave them all together so that you know exactly where these songs came from in Peggy Lee's life, and a little bit of context there, and a little bit of this fabulously odd, wacky, action-packed story that is the Peggy Lee story. So essentially, it is my book brought to life on stage.
Oh, and the book is marvelous, so this is going to be a marvelous stage performance, no doubt about it. James Gavin, author of Is That All There Is? The Strange Life of Peggy Lee. We're talking with him right now. You can come see him in person next Monday night. Be there at the Guthrie, 7:30. You might win some tickets, too, tomorrow here on the show, and then again on Friday. Legacy of Peggy Lee.
Yes. Stan, I want to just quickly say before we wrap it up, I just love your radio delivery. It's the kind of delivery we just don't hear anymore. That you have the voice of radio that I grew up listening to on the radio and have missed ever since, and now I'm getting to talk to you on the air. I'm so tickled.
Oh, my goodness, James. I don't know what to do with that, but thank you so much. I appreciate it. And James Gavin, in a couple of words, Peggy Lee's legacy. What is it?
Cool heat.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That says it. You're wonderful, sir. Thank you. Thank you. A man of...
Please come to the show. I've got to meet you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, James, for all you do.
Thank you.
And you are welcome, sir.
And all that you do. I'll appreciate you very much. Thank you, Stan.
You'll have a full house, James, and thank you, too. Bobby J., thank you, and Jen and everybody. We're just about out of time, aren't we, Bobby, huh? Okay.
Yep, we are.
What a marvelous guy. Bobby, read this book.
Oh, yeah.
You too, Jenna. This is one heck of a read. It's about our gal here from James Town, North Dakota. That's our show. Thank you so much, folks. We're going to go out with Peggy. Who else at this point, huh? Peggy Lee. We have more tickets to give away tomorrow and then again on Friday, so be with us here. Thank you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
House is shining like a dime. Feed the baby, grease the car, and powder my face at the same time. Get all dressed up, go out and swing till 4 a.m. and then lay down at 5, jump up at 6, and start all over again.